Hello, London. We are ready for your vote.
Hello, I'm Stephen Perkins, and this is Douzepoir, the Eurovision podcast from the team behind BingeWatch. It is Monday, 29th of April, and we are just over 1 week away from the 2024 contest in Malmö. Rehearsals are now well underway for all the acts taking part in this year's competition, which means that not a day goes by without a tantalising photo or clip being released that allows us to feverishly speculate which country is definitely going to win this year. We've got one of our trademark deep-ish dives coming up for you, but let's start today's show with a quick look at a couple of the headlines from the past week. First up, after a few sneaky leaks last week, and try saying that three times quickly because I've had to re-record this bit five times already, host broadcaster SVT have officially unveiled the stage for this year's contest at the Malmö Arena. It looks pretty impressive. There are five LED lightbox cubes suspended above the arena, huge video screens, and a stage in the shape of a cross. Apparently over 1,000 square metres of LED technology make up the stage this year, so we can expect lots of dazzling visuals. And six stage managers plus an additional crew of 36 have got the unenviable job of making sure everyone's props get removed and installed in the 55 seconds between songs. This year's production designer Florian Vida said, "I am so happy to be part of the Eurovision family again. Putting together an exceptional show is a team effort, and I am proud to be part of a dream team of professionals. Just the right constellation of people to come up with something different and new. We all have the same vision of what this show should be and how to take Eurovision to the next level. And for me, Sweden is always a guarantor of good music and entertainment." Back on the local front, the BBC is engaging in a little bit of cross-promotion ahead of this year's contest, as they've confirmed that UK representative Ollie Alexander is set to make a guest appearance on EastEnders. The episode is set to air on Thursday the 2nd of May, and we'll see Ollie popping into the Queen Vic after rehearsing his Eurovision performance nearby, apparently being a friend of Walford resident Johnny Carter, and subsequently being given a hero's welcome by the locals. Ollie said, "I wanted to surprise my mum as it's her favourite show, but I guess the cat is out of the bag now, she's gonna love it." Last year, Swedish radio commentator Carolina Norén made headlines following her appearance on the Eurotrip podcast, during which she revealed that she had spoken to Eurovision Song Contest executive producer Martin Österdahl and petitioned for the Big Five rule, that's the one which allows France, Germany, Italy, Spain and the United Kingdom to qualify automatically for the final without having to compete in the semi-finals, to be dropped from the competition, citing the unfairness to all of the other competing nations. It's no great surprise that her suggestion was not taken up. Indeed, if anything, the Big Five have been given an extra leg up this year, with the news that they will get to perform their songs live and in full during the semi-finals without facing the televote. But her comments did inspire a fresh round of discussion about the Big Five, and whether it's right or fair for them to get an advantage at Eurovision. So, with that in mind, I thought for this week's feature I'd take a little wander through the history of the Big Five as a concept, or the Big Four as it was for the first 11 years, and see what we can learn from it. Now, the Big Five system made its debut in Stockholm in 2000, but the seeds were sown somewhat earlier, and we need to make our way back to 1993 to see how it all started coming about. We have covered some of this on the podcast before, so apologies for retreading on some old ground, but the context here is important, I think. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were a lot of newly independent countries looking to make their mark on the world, and a part of that was gaining entrance to the Eurovision Song Contest. This left the contest organisers with a fairly big logistical problem because they couldn't accommodate them all without extending the running time of the contest to a duration that they would be uncomfortable with. A temporary stopgap was introduced in 1993 where a pre-qualifying round held in Slovenia was introduced for seven countries wishing to compete at Eurovision for the first time, with three spots available in that year's contest, which eventually went to Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia and Slovenia. 1 year later, in 1994, a relegation system was introduced where the seven countries at the bottom of the 1993 leaderboard, that's Belgium, Israel, Slovenia, Denmark, Turkey, Luxembourg and Cyprus, had to sit out for a year to allow seven new countries to make their debut: Estonia, Hungary, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, Russia and Slovakia. However, Cyprus did get a reprieve later when Italy decided not to take part that year, and as the best performing relegated country the previous year, Cyprus were allowed to return after all. The same system was in place for 1995, where the seven lowest ranked countries from 94 were set to be relegated to allow the countries who sat out in 94 to return. Except this time Luxembourg and Italy both declined to return, which meant that Spain and Austria were spared the cull after disappointing finishes the year before. However, 1996 is where it all hit the fan. This time, the only country with a guaranteed spot in the contest was Norway, by virtue of having won the previous year and being the host country. Every other hopeful nation was diverted into an audio-only pre-selection round, where a group of national juries, comprising a different selection of jurors to the ones that would be used for the final, voted, after hearing the songs on tape only, to decide the 22 countries who would advance to the final. Following this initial round of voting, the entries from Hungary, Germany, Denmark, Macedonia, Russia, Israel, and Romania were eliminated. There were a lot of problems with this system. For one, a lot of people weren't even really aware it was happening, leading to a fair degree of surprise when certain countries were absent from the contest, especially if your country happened to be one of them. For another, a lot of countries objected to having gone to the time and effort of organising their own Eurovision selection process, often at considerable expense, and then to be eliminated from the contest in what felt like an unfair and rather opaque qualifying round. The jury results from this round weren't even intended to be made public at all, but they did end up eventually getting released in full. But by far the biggest issue here was the absence of Germany, one of the founding nations of Eurovision, and the only country that had competed at every single contest prior to that point. Understandably, Germany did not take rejection well, and reacted by punting the coverage of that year's contest onto a smaller channel. This in turn was quite frustrating for host broadcaster NRK, who'd been marketing that year's contest with a certain expectation of bums on seats that they didn't quite get, with one of the contest's biggest markets not really turning up to watch. The fact that Germany was one of the main contributors to Eurovision's financial coffers made the whole thing even more awkward. So, the audio-only qualifier was ditched after 1996, and they returned to the relegation system for 1997, but this time with a twist. It was calculated based on average points over the previous four contests, so a country with an otherwise strong track record wouldn't necessarily have to sit out due to one off year. However, by 1998, Germany was set to miss qualifying for the contest again due to tying points-wise for the final spot with Slovenia, and Slovenia's higher score in the 1997 contest being used as a tiebreak. It was only thanks to Italy declining to compete once again after their brief return in 1997 that a free spot opened up for Germany to compete in 1998 after all. So, in 1999, a new rule was proposed to be implemented from the next year's contest onward. France, Germany, Spain, and the United Kingdom would become the Big Four countries, and would automatically qualify for the contest due to their significant financial contribution to the event and the risk to Eurovision's bottom line if their poor form led to them being relegated. Arguably not a particularly fair situation, but one that was designed with the long-term survival of the contest in mind. This change in direction came in the nick of time for France, who were spared relegation in the year 2000 after poor performances in three of the previous four contests, and the ongoing run of bad form would otherwise have seen both France and Spain sitting out in 2001. However, the main criticism of the Big Four system, other than the creation of an unlevel playing field, is that it disincentivised those countries from trying very hard, knowing that they could send a half-hearted entry that would garner little interest and still suffer no consequences other than perhaps momentary humiliation on the night. Indeed, things came rather to a head in Kyiv in 2005, when the Big Four countries were the four bottom countries on the leaderboard, Spain in 21st place, the United Kingdom in 22nd place, France in 23rd, and Germany at the bottom in 24th place. It didn't particularly inspire anyone to buck their ideas up for 2006 either, because the highest placing by any Big Four country that year was Germany in 14th, with the United Kingdom 19th, Spain 21st, and France 22nd. In fact, since the introduction of the Big Four, which became the Big Five in 2011 following the return of fellow deep-pocketed nation Italy to the contest, there have only been two occasions where all of the big countries finished in the top 20. And when you consider what a low bar that is in the first place, it's pretty damning. The United Kingdom and Germany are perhaps the worst offenders, with five last place finishes each since the system was brought in, compared to a mere one each for France and Spain. Or, if you want to look at it another way, in the 24 contests of the Big 4/5 era, France have finished outside the top 20 9 times, Spain 11 times, and the United Kingdom and Germany 12 each. Italy is working on slightly different metrics because they were only taking part in 12 of those contests, but they are still on a different level. They've only finished outside the top 20 once in 2014, compared to 10 top 10 finishes. Looking at podium positions alone, there's not a lot to shout about there either. Italy are in front again with a win in 2021, as well as being runners-up in 2011 and 2019, and third place in 2015. Germany are the only other Big Five country to win in 2010, but with no other top three finishes, though they did squeak a fourth place result in 2018. France have one second place finishing in 2021, the United Kingdom has a second place in 2022 and a third place in 2002, and Spain has a single third place finish in 2022. So where does this leave us in terms of Carolina Norian's argument that the Big Five system needs to be ditched? Obviously, being in the United Kingdom myself and having benefited hugely from it, I'm hardly impartial, but I think there are arguments in favour of keeping it. Hear me out on this one. First of all, and let's assume that when I talk about the problems of the Big Five system, I'm not talking about Italy because their track record since their return in 2011 is pretty much beyond reproach. I think the other Big Four countries have gradually started to recognise that constantly occupying the lower echelons of the scoreboard is neither dignified nor sustainable, and that it's generally getting everybody else's backs up, so they are making more of an effort to send genuinely competitive entries, as the results from Barbara Pravi, Sam Ryder and Chanel in recent years have proven. Similarly, you look at this year's lineup, and the UK is sending Ollie Alexander, who, whatever you feel about his song, is the first genuinely established contemporary pop artist we've sent since Blue in 2011, and France are sending Slimane, who's also a genuinely huge star over there. There's still something of a question mark over what Germany and Spain are trying right now, and I think their entries could go any number of ways, but I do think all of these countries are now taking Eurovision a little bit more seriously, genuinely trying to experiment with their approach to try and find that golden touch, that magic ingredient that makes for Eurovision success. As for the money question, it's pretty difficult to say how fair it is without having any hard and fast figures to examine. It's usually down to the discretion of the host broadcaster whether to reveal the participation fees in a given year, and a lot of them, to be perfectly honest, don't. It's worth bearing in mind that Russia were reportedly paying quite a large sum to participate in Eurovision every year, and following their ban in 2023, which doesn't seem likely to be lifted anytime soon, that's bound to have made a dent in the contest's finances, so they're probably not looking to rock the boat with any of their other major funders. It's also certainly possible that the Big Five are subsidising some of the smaller nations in the first place. We already have some countries wanting to compete, but saying that the cost of taking part in Eurovision is simply prohibitive on their budget, and if one of the Big Five countries took their money and ran, it's likely that everyone else's fees would go up, which could mean even more countries having to pull out because they can't afford to take part, and potentially creating a vicious circle of ever-increasing costs for everyone who remains. Then there's viewership to consider. Viewing habits may have changed, streaming and online viewing may count for much more nowadays, but the Eurovision Song Contest is still a huge appointment to view live event on linear channels of the kind we don't get too many of nowadays, and one which commands a huge worldwide audience. A country competing in the final tends to guarantee viewers tuning in that nation, so having five of their biggest European markets locked in every year is probably not something the EBU wants to mess with. Ultimately, I guess where this leaves me is that the Big Five system may not be fair, but it might well be necessary for boring, unsexy financial reasons, at this moment in time at least. As a viewer, I know I want the Big Five countries to take their responsibilities seriously, to recognise that they haven't always treated a guaranteed spot in the Eurovision final as the privilege that it is, and to show up genuinely fighting to win. We might be getting there very slowly, but I think we are starting to see the countries getting into that mindset. With the field in 2024 looking to be one of the most competitive Eurovision Song Contests in quite some time, I'm intrigued to see how the Big Five fare this time. I'd be very surprised if France and Italy don't make the top 10, but what's in store for Germany, Spain and the United Kingdom this year is still something most of us are a bit hazier in our predictions about. Those results on the 11th of May are going to make for interesting viewing, that's for sure. That's all from me for this week. Next week, of course, will be the semi-finals, so expect to be hearing a lot more from us as we bring you reactions, analysis and predictions in the wake of the live shows. Make sure to hit subscribe on your podcast platform of choice so that you won't miss any of our episodes in the contest week, and follow us on Twitter at @BingeWatch_pod and @StephenPerkins. Until next time, good night Europe and good morning Australia.